Today's lecture will be rather slower than in some other cases. And the reason for this is the following. Throughout most of the book, you will see an immense quantity of equations. And they are sort of progressed in an algebraically correct way. But what I should like to do is take one example of the construction of a pseudo-equilibrium stellar system model, and really trying to do every single step with comments. The reason for this is that will hopefully help you seeing what ingredients go in here in a more precise way than what we have been doing so far. And with more precise, I mean that it will now more or less verbatim follow the equations in the book. And I will try to explain in a little bit more detail what every single step was about. The example I have chosen is the one that is in section 4.3a, polytropes and the Plummer model. The Plummer model has the advantage that it's algebraically childishly simple. So it's something that you can instantly write down and instantly remember. And yet every single step in its treatment effectively points to an aspect of stellar dynamics that we have been discussing, and an aspect of stellar dynamics that is important in every single application thereof, even those that are more, very, very much more complicated than the Plummer model. So, in the next two lectures, we will go relatively slowly through only a few pages of text in the book. Right. So what I should like you to do is take the equations for granted. I will every now and then write them out just to be able to point to certain things. Now, let us see. You will recall that the basic problem that we're always confronted with in a theory of stellar systems is that on the one hand, we have an overall potential, sort of an average distribution of mass and its consequent potential, connected together by Poisson's equation. All right. So the Laplacian of the potential is connected with the mass density distribution. Then the second thing is that in such a potential, we know that the potential itself is made up of the individual particles as they orbit in that potential. And it is the connection between these two that gives us a self-consistency problem. So the orbits and the potential would have to be generated in such a way that they cover each other, as it were. The key difficulty there is something that we had also discussed from the very, very start. And that is the fact that Poisson's equation, in a sense, is cheating. Because this function here, the density distribution of matter, is, if you look at it in detail, not a continuous differentiable function. It is effectively a sum of delta functions, where every single delta function is made up by a single star over here, which presumably is a point mass under these in this approximation. Now, the complication there then is that if you were to say, well, I'm going to make a density out of this distribution by stipulating that I take boxes in which I take an average total mass density by just averaging over all the stars in there, then we are stuck with what we had defined as a subgrid model. And I advocated in the previous two lectures that algebraically we see this subgrid model back in terms of the collision factor, the collision term, in the Boltzmann equation. It effectively says what happens on a very, very small scale. Now, looking forward towards some of the steps in the Plummer model treatment that I will be discussing, it is important to realize that this subgrid model, in the case of gas dynamics, is drastically different from what it is in the case of stellar dynamics. Those of you who have followed lectures in gas dynamics and in statistical mechanics will recall that one of the key assumptions in finding that collision term in the classical Boltzmann equation is that the interaction is local and instantaneous. That is to say, you presume that if a particle in phase space is on a phase orbit and another particle is on another phase orbit, that they will then collide at exactly one point, after which they will jump to another point in phase space. Where they may end up, of course, is all determined by conservation laws. But that is straightforward. And thereafter, they continue their path in phase space. The success of Boltzmann's theory is evident, right? So this is just perfectly above board. However, the discrepancy between the Boltzmann model and a stellar dynamics system is also evident. We already know, because for a single delta function over here, the solution is a 1 over r potential, just the Newtonian potential. There is no such thing as a fixed position where a collision occurs. You may say that is also the case in the case of gas dynamics, all right, in the case of statistical mechanics, because particles have a finite size. They aren't point masses. Well, then I say, well, this piece here, right, is extremely narrow as compared with the total extent of your physical system. So this is a very, very, very small thing as compared to the total system. But you can't have that with a 1 over r potential. So the subgrid model in the case of stellar dynamics requires a little bit of extra thought. And I will return to this by the time that we get to the crucial step where this subgrid model appears. And that happens in a somewhat surprising fashion, so I will warn you about this. Let's then see what we can try and do. The first step is to try and find a good guess for the distribution function of the system. There again, let me reiterate what we had previously. Df by dt can be written as the dt by dt and then the partial derivative plus the dx by dt and then the partial derivative with respect to x. I'm ignoring the spatial content now, okay, so I'm not really writing inner products here. You all know that the position is a vector dv by dt and df by dv. We do not continue, all right, because accelerations are direct observables. Now then, as we had seen previously, all we need to do is connect the dots over here. This one we know is a velocity, that we know is an acceleration, and this one, of course, is unity, and there we are. In the case of a zero collision system, this would be zero, so the subgrid model there would say, okay, this is zeros. And in the case of a time-independent distribution function, this term would also disappear. So we just simply have to solve this particular expression equal to zero. And there again, we already see where our subgrid model is. In the acceleration here is where the potential goes in. And this, effectively, this velocity here, is a result from this orbital calculation over here. That gives you your velocity distribution as a function of space. All right, so this your orbit comes in here. Now, how is this done in the case of a continuum model such as the Plummer model? The first step is equation 483, where it is assumed that the distribution function is a function of energy only. You will hopefully recall that this is taking a page from statistical mechanics. In statistical mechanics, you know that the only internal degree of freedom that you have left over is the mean energy per particle, also known as the temperature. The momenta are unimportant. They only become important in the case of statistical mechanics by the time you graduate to gas dynamics, where you have a systematic speed of all the particles, which we call the wind speed, and you have a random speed of the particles, which is just simply the thermal energy. So, assuming then that the variables in this function here, which of course you know are position, velocity, and time, that the only variable that is left over in this function is the energy. Now then, the assumption then is that there are no negative energy states. That's simply a stability requirement, and that there is another term for positive energies, which is a constant factor times, and this may surprise you, the energy to some sort of power. I could write M or something in here as a power. In retrospect, it turns out to be useful to write this in a slightly different fashion, looking ahead to the results. People write as N minus 3/2. So there again, there's nothing magical in this. You might simply have taken N minus 3/2 as M, or as K, or as L, or something thereabouts. It doesn't really matter, as long as it is a real number. Now then, this already anticipates that N is going to be an integer. That's a sort of already a sort of suggestive notation. This is not necessary. All right, it will turn out that in the Plummer model, n equals 5, but that is not necessary. Right? It can be any positive number over here. Well then, this is a power law. Why is it sensible to work with power laws in this particular case? And this is something that will come back in some of the other steps that we're going to be considering as well. A power law is scale-free. There is no intrinsic energy scale in the system. There is no intrinsic length scale. There's no intrinsic mass scale. And we know from first principles in mathematics that if you have a system that is scale-free, its functions are power laws. Right? Why does it make sense to do that? Well, that all harks back to what I already said about Poisson's equation over here. If the density is shrunk to a single particle, we know that the potential is proportional to 1 over r. And that's a scale-free function. There is no intrinsic length scale in gravity. Consequently, it makes a certain amount of sense to then presume that other functions that describe gravitating systems will also be scale-free. We'll come back to this a little bit later in the second time. Now, when we do this, that will allow us to find directly a solution to Poisson's equation. Because all we have to do is take this function, integrate it over all velocities, and that will give us the density distribution in space. And that density distribution we put in here, and then we solve this equation over here. So then that means that having made this choice, we already implicitly have made a choice for the way in which the potential behaves. Well, that is done in the next equation in the book. You'll see why I go slowly here. That is in 4.84. I'll just write out the first version thereof. So this density equals 4 pi times the integral over all velocities and over all velocity space. There's no vector in here, even in the equation 4.84, because, of course, if you use only an energy, it's isotropic, right? It's just a v squared. So, times the energy, okay, there will be v squared, times the distribution function that we... All right, they use... Yeah, okay.
I use phi here. They, I'm sorry for this. Already wrote this down, so I'm going to leave it. They use capital psi in the book. Never mind. Of course, it means the same. Okay, minus 1/2 v, 1/2 v squared. And you work this out. All right. This is, of course, 4 pi f, where f is this prefactor. Prefactor is uninteresting, of course, because it all scales. Only positive energies, so square root of 0 to, where are we? Square root of 2 psi. All right. Oh, sorry for this. They use psi. Okay. And then, of course, v squared. And then this whole expression here to this factor over here. So there's n minus 3/2. This turns out to be integrable if you do a small substitution of variables. And that substitution is done in the line below, 484 v squared proportion to cosine squared theta. In which case, you find out that the density is proportional to the to a certain power of the potential. So the net result is that the density is proportional to the nth power of the potential. And this is, in retrospect, why we write the exponent in this way. Had we done this differently, then, of course, we would have found plus 3/2 over here. Those of you who like such things will already have noticed that the number of spatial dimensions in our universe is sort of hidden in here in the forms of this 3/2 term over here. Well, even this prefactor can be worked out analytically. It is some sort of complicated expression that is in 485b, but that's not really very interesting over here. So, the next remark that is made in the book is already very interesting, and that is that already from this requirement here, we can make a very far-reaching statement about such stellar systems in general. I'm just going to read out the sentence and then try to explain it a little bit. It says, in these models, the density rises as the nth power of the relative potential, as long as it is positive. Well, that's this expression over here. And it is zero when the potential is negative. Now, let us assume, then, that n would be equal to zero, which means that the density is constant. We just have an infinite universe filled with stars. Right, well, let us see what happens in that case. That means that the prefactor that is over here becomes negative. So we need n to be bigger than 1/2 in order to end up with a proper prefactor over here. So already we have found out that an infinite stellar system is impossible, right? You sort of understand this already, because if you have an infinite stellar system, it can sort of shrink a little bit and gain an enormous amount of energy, and then the rest would be able to disperse. Having found this distribution then here, this density proportion to the nth power of the potential, you will see that if you put that in Poisson's equation, you get an equation for the potential only, because this one here is proportional to the nth power of this potential. That means, then, that you will be able to write down an equation for the potential as a whole. So with Poisson's equation taken into account, you find, oh, by the way, the Poisson's equation in spherical coordinates is something you can just look up in the book. Okay, so any mathematics handbook will tell you this. R squared d phi by dr, okay, that is the spherical case, plus, I'll just simply get this to the left-hand side, and I'm going to write down 4 pi g times c sub n, and that is this constant over here,
All right. Times phi to the power n equals 0. Cool. Now, the question that you can ask yourself is, what good solutions can we find here? What is, the step that is done in the book is a little bit vague, so I will try to amend that. Suddenly, without any warning, in the book they start talking about polytropic gases have an equation of state P equals kappa rho to the gamma. Well, this may all be true, but we're talking about stellar dynamics, and this sentence alone presupposes an enormous amount of knowledge in the part of the reader on gas dynamics and statistical mechanics. So let me skip that particular bit, because the essential part is stated a little bit later, and that is equation 488. So even if you were to skip 487, equation 488 is of the essence. What is done is the following. The authors start to make a subgrid model. And there I come back to the happenings in this little box of the cellar system over here. The presumption is that the energy density is proportional to a positive power of the mass density. Now, again, this exponent here is gamma minus 1, and that is again done with hindsight. You could have given it any real number here. It doesn't really matter as long as it's positive. Okay. The energy density in an ordinary thermodynamic system, in an ordinary particle system, the energy density typically goes by another name, and is known as the pressure. The pressure is simply the energy per cubic meter, as it were. This, then, is known as an equation of state in thermodynamics. But why is it that we can use that over here? That's already written over here, because we use the energy as our free variable in the distribution function. And that comes back here. So we can use that just as well as if we were talking about a system of massive particles. However, we do not have such a thing as an equation of state in a stellar system. A stellar system is not a gas, a compressible gas, or a diesel engine, or something of that general sort. Instead, we have what I kept referring to as a subgrid model. That is really what we are talking about here. And that is why I explain this particular bit in the book in a slightly roundabout way. This is what we have been talking about all the time. In equation of state of this type in a thermodynamic theory is all based on such a Boltzmannian collision term. All right. Why is it useful both in a thermodynamic system and in the case of a self-gravitating stellar system? The reason for this, again, is the fact that we're talking about a scale-free system. There is no intrinsic scale. So using power laws is always a useful thing to do. All right, so the energy density proportional to a positive power of the mass density. There again, we just use the same trick all over again, right? The fact that we can use scale-free systems and therefore power laws. Well then, let me make a little footnote as to how this can be different in the case of a particle system, so in the case of particle dynamics, gas dynamics, statistical mechanics, and in the case of stars.
Those of you who have taken courses in statistical mechanics will realize that if you use this type of collision term, a Boltzmann-type collision term, you end up with the ideal gas laws, right? Something that looks like this, an ideal equation of state, where this exponent over here, this exponent gamma, relates to the internal degrees of freedom of the particles. If you have a point particle, all right, this quantity over here is 5/3, exactly 5 divided by exactly 3, right? So it's a rational number. If you have diatomic molecules that have more internal degrees of freedom and therefore can absorb more energy than a point particle can in various ways, you have to count all the internal degrees of freedom as well, because that is what statistical mechanics is all about, statistical mechanics. And then this quantity is different again, and it can be, it must be at least unity, all right, over here. Well then, again, think about statistical mechanics. What difference does it make that there is an intrinsic length scale? I want to remind you of the fact that if the attraction of an individual particle, the force that particles feel with respect to one another as a function of radius, is not some sort of power law, but is a van der Waals form, like this, life becomes drastically different. Because in that case, there is, in fact, an intrinsic length scale, which is the size where of the length scale where this potential, this force law, bottoms out. Okay. That's what it's all about. Sorry, I did this wrong. Having done this, you know that the net result is going to be drastically different. You do no longer have an ideal gas, as in this particular case. If you introduce a length scale, for instance, via the van der Waals trick, then all of a sudden you get a system where a gas can condense into a liquid. All right. Drastically different from the ideal gas law. And that is done precisely by this one trick, introducing a finite length scale. What is the analog of this in the case of stellar dynamics? Again, looking back at the subgrid model. Right? So the equation of state for a gas corresponds to the subgrid model for a stellar system. I mentioned a number of times during the lectures that if in this subgrid box there is an active ingredient such as a binary star that can exchange energy with the other stars that come by, your subgrid model acquires an intrinsic scale. In the case of a binary star, this could, for instance, be the semi-major axis of the binary or the binding energy or something of that general, the evaporation energy or something of that general sort. Or even, you might include the physical size of the stars as a length scale. That's rather drastic and doesn't typically apply, but it is something that you might consider. I'm giving you this footnote in order to make a connection between what you already know about the behavior of ordinary gases and liquids and what we are in the process of learning about stellar systems. So, in the absence of such a length scale, we will have a subgrid model, presumably only based on scale-free potentials, in which case we are justified in saying that this energy density is directly proportional to the mass density, with some power. Now, as already mentioned, in the case of an ideal gas, this gamma here is 5/3, and we may wonder what it is in the case of a stellar gas, a gas consisting of stars that orbit through space. And let us now consider how that goes. Here, we will find that this energy density, of course, in equilibrium corresponds to the potential over here. So what we can now do is we can say that this rho to the gamma minus 1 equals some prefactor times the potential. And the prefactor for
normalization reasons. They write like this, but that makes relatively little sense because this is still a free concert anyway. Oh, by the way, those of you who remember their statistical mechanics, this constant K or kappa that they have in equation 487 turns out to be the logarithm of the entropy. All right. So in the case of an ordinary gas, this also has a thermodynamic significance. If you put this in here, you will find out that this N, which we put in here, which we inherited, all right, from this expression over here, is, of course, related to this quantity over here. And I'll just simply write it down. It's equation 489, that this gamma is equal to 1 plus 1 over N. Right. So far, so good. This is just purely a mathematical exercise based on basically this one physics ingredient, namely to take this scale-free behavior as our guiding principle. Now, that is, of course, not what is of interest to our friends and their telescopes. They want to know what the light distribution is, what the mass distribution is, what the velocity distribution is in such a system. Well, the velocity distribution goes directly back to the energy prescription, just simply 1/2 v squared. That's relatively straightforward. The appearance in the sky of this galaxy, this stellar system, we also had already presumed, because as you can see over here, we are presuming that the system is spherically symmetric. Okay, so we have a spherical stellar system over here. Everything just a function of R, which is why, of course, the Poisson equation appears in this particular guise over here. Now, let us then see if we can compute from this what, for instance, the mass distribution in such a system is. Well, you know what that is like. It's again harks back to Poisson's equation. So let me see if I can put that on here. This is really equation bonanza today, but you get my drift. Again, copying from the book, the mass that you find within a certain radius, m is a function of r, you just simply find by differentiating the potential, so it equals minus, and so r squared over g times d phi by dr. And if you put this in, you will immediately find from the equation over there what the proportionality is going to be. It's proportional to the following factor, r to the power n minus 3 over, sorry for that, n minus 1. Again, a power law, and this is not surprising. Right. Now, I've given the whole thing in terms of what is written in the book, just simply to follow their argument. Having found this, you already hopefully see straight away that you might have taken a different road to the same result. You might have said, for instance, I will not start from a supposition about the potential. I will start with a supposition about the mass distribution. And there again, using a scale-free distribution, a power law like this, will already be a good starting point. Right. So that is perfectly valid. And then you would just simply run the whole show in reverse. But the same arguments will hold at the same steps. You have a question?
Yes, I'm assuming there's another parenthesis.
I beg your pardon?
In the power, there's a parenthesis missing.
Oh, am I missing something? Sorry for that. Oh, yeah, you're quite right. My apologies. Yes, sorry for that. That was quite a different result. Thank you. I appreciate that. Good. Now, the...
The various possibilities over here are, of course, enumerated in the book, just below equation 490, which is basically what this is. And for n bigger than 3, all right, this turns out to be an infinite number. The next step that people undertake is to make the equation that I have over here slightly different, and it's effectively only a trick, right? What you will see is that if you turn to equation 491b, that's effectively the same equation as this, only it is rescaled in a certain way. The reason it's rescaled is that then it takes on the same form as a similar equation that describes, in the classical theory, the structure of stars. And this is something that is not very surprising, because that effectively comes back to what we've been saying here. If you take this equation over here for this for a self-gravitating system and you use a Boltzmannian system, then you will end up with an equation of state that prescribes, blah, 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 via all these calculations, what this power over here is going to be. And then you still get an equilibrium solution. In that case, however, the equilibrium pertains not to the sum total of the orbits of the individual stars in such a system, but the sum total of the collisions of all the individual particles. Right, so rather than having an equation of state for a gas, you have a subgrid model. If you don't have a subgrid model, but you have an equation of state, then you end up with an equation that algebraically is the same as this one. And that is known as the Lane-Emden equation, which is a very famous equation in stellar structure. In conclusion, what one should, of course, dearly like to do is to find a general solution to this equation. Now, in this day and age of electronic computers and things, you wouldn't think about this twice. This is a very straightforward second-order differential equation, and there's any number of packages and stuff that will solve this in no time at all numerically on your computer. Historically speaking, however, this is not how people did it. What people did is saying, can we find an analytic solution of this, something that we can express in ordinary, well-known, and well-loved mathematical functions? And the answer is you cannot, with one very notable exception. That notable exception is n equals 5. And again, let us trace back where that n came from. That came basically from this assumption over here. The power of the energy in the distribution function. As I had already mentioned, and we'll repeat that now, there is nothing really special about this exponent over here. Could be any positive number, right? It doesn't really matter. Algebraically, however, it turns out that if n equals 5, this thing solves itself straightforwardly, right? Which is something that you can verify for yourself if you please. If you don't want to do it in particular, you will find that it is written down in equation 493 in the book. The nice thing about it is that this then gives us, in its turn, a solution for the potential. You simply put this in, and what do we find? We find a potential that scales, and I'm just writing down the scaled form over here. It's called psi in the book, which is equal to 1 over the square root 1 plus s squared, where s is the scale in terms of a rescaling function that is given here. I'm going to rewrite this in this particular case, because that is where we want to connect it, Okay. It turns out that the corresponding potential, then, that is put in here, that we get out of there for your Poisson's equation over here, that is proportional to 1 over the square root of r squared plus b squared, where b is a certain number, right? This dependence here is what we had already put in Plummer's law. So that is exactly Plummer's potential, Plummer's solution over here. If in the fullness of time I get my demonstration computer code running for you people, then you will find that is precisely the way in which it has been programmed in. So there again, there is nothing really holy or special about this particular expression. But the reason that it is emphasized in the book, and the reason that I emphasize it to you now in this particular summary, is that it shows the way things work at every single step. Right? It is a very good, it's not even a toy model, it's a very serious model for a stellar system. But every ingredient that we have been talking about, you have now seen represented in an algebraic way, in a mathematically correct step, rather than just me talking about it. To conclude then, let us go through this once again and let us try and identify those things from this particular treatment that are general and those things that are specific. And I would maintain that practically everything in here is general, right? Now, so let's follow the argument all the way from the beginning. What did we want to do? We wanted to construct a self-consistent stellar system. That is to say, we wanted to have a potential that is constructed in such a way that if you take all the stars orbiting in it together, that those stars together generate that potential. Right? Then you have a self-consistent system. Now, the first step we took here is saying that this density distribution was assumed to be a continuous function. And already warned you that this is not the case in reality. It is a sum of delta functions. So once you make this assumption that there is such a thing as a continuous distribution, then you're already on the road to an approximation. Right? The next step is completely general. The reason for this, of course, is that the Collisioners-Boltzmann equation is perfectly general. The step thereafter we took is writing down a presumption for the distribution function and saying that it would be a function of energy only. Secretly, we have put in here the supposition that the system is spherically symmetric. Can you identify how we have done this? We've done this by secretly assuming that the energy is proportional to the square of the velocity. But that's not necessarily so in a stellar system. A stellar system doesn't necessarily have a velocity distribution that is isotropic, as we had already been discussing previously. It is perfectly possible to have one that is anisotropic, and I have demonstrated one to you with my computer demo last week, where we had a stellar system that was made out of a disk where the stars rotated prograde in one half and the other half was rotating retrograde. And you had seen in front of your eyes that after a number of timescales of evolution, we had a system that was still flat, but where you know that the total angular momentum is zero because I put it in that way. Half the stars one way, the other half the stars the other way. No angular momentum and still it's flat. It is flat because of the anisotropy of the velocity distribution, with very few vertical velocities and a lot horizontal in a disk-like plane. So that's also general. The fact that we had presumed this to be a power law is also directly general, right? Because this is just simply our gravitational potential. If we have something different, it would be different. Now, the whole system here then ends up effectively with something that is much more applicable than just plain simply this n equals 5. In terms of your term paper, so to speak, right, it would be of interest to see if you can come up with a family of solutions for arbitrary values of n. Right, that's just something that you can do on a computer. Right, I'm not really saying that this is enough for a term paper, but this is typically an example where we do not do it in the book, we do not do it in the lectures, but it is something that might give you some ideas. Yeah. What is so special about this? And you will see, if you do that, that the families of solutions that you develop all bear very, very, very close resemblance one to the other. Right? That's not a trivial thing to do. Again, what could be done differently in this case? Well, again, follow the thing all the way back to the same thing again. What we could do differently is effectively sort of two different classes of approach. One class of approach is doing this very literally and saying, I start with a potential. I then put a number of stars in that potential, and with an electronic computer, I compute what the stellar orbits are. Then I take those orbits and I say, I superimpose them one on another with certain weight factors, and those weight factors I use in such a way that I approximate the original potential as good as possible. So, for instance, if you start stars with halo orbits like this, or with core orbits like that, and you have a centrally concentrated potential, the weight factor that you have to give to this orbit over here is going to be bigger than the weight factor you have to give over there. You simply take a sum of orbits that then makes up your total potential. That's one thing, way in which you can do it. Another way in which you can do it is saying, well, maybe I could relax the assumption that we have a spherical system here. That will introduce one extra degree of freedom, and I think you already see where this occurs. That is where this velocity and this acceleration come in, because they have now a vectorial property, which also means that this distribution function now becomes a sum or a product of distribution functions that are energies that are different in different spatial directions. This is bizarre if you think in terms of thermodynamics, which is just locally isotropic, but it is not so bizarre in a collisionless system where you can easily have star streams crossing one another in a way that you would never see it on the freeway. That means then that an expression like this for the density distribution becomes a little bit more complicated. It also means, of course, that this equation over here can no longer be maintained. But Poisson's equation is no longer the spherically symmetric case we had over here, but you will have at least two coordinates, right? So you have a coupled set of equations in that case. You may wonder if there are any solutions to this. Now, this was a game that was very popular in the 1980s and 1990s, and indeed some people, such as our former scientific director, Tim DeZeo, have found some very fascinating general solutions in this particular case. But again, I want to emphasize to you that the steps that you take are precisely the same steps that we have delineated over here. They will lead to different results with different assumptions, but again, that's the case. Finally, having seen all this, of course, we need to hark to our dear colleagues at the telescope. The question then becomes, how realistic is this? Does this kind of procedure really produce stellar systems that plausibly resemble what we actually observe in the sky? And surprisingly enough, the answer is yes, it comes very close. For instance, this Plummer model is not famous for nothing. If you were to use this kind of distribution, then it is already a reasonable approximation of some stellar systems such as globular clusters, right? One might think that this is reasonable because globular clusters contain zero or practically zero gas. If you want to do this in terms of, let us say, a spiral galaxy, which can consist easily of 15% gas or something thereabouts, then your story might be completely different. question for elliptical galaxies, again, is slightly different. You might say, well, we have some hints over here as to how to evolve systems that are not spherically symmetric, but of course there are elliptical galaxies that are close enough to spherical. There the situation is that it doesn't really work quite so well. And the reason for this is, again written over here, that it is precisely what's happening in the inner parts of such systems that are drastically different from what we get under these circumstances. Where should we look for a discrepancy? Well, again and again and again, we should look at this subgrid model for a source of discrepancies. In actual galaxy centers, the situation is different to the extent that the characteristic timescale is exceedingly short as the characteristic times compared to the characteristic timescale elsewhere, which means that you'll get subgrid effects such as encounters between stars and binaries that become very, very important, and therefore the rest of this story requires immense modification. Also, but this is something that we will not be treating in this class in very much detail, all of you know that in the centers of galaxies there are supermassive black holes, objects with 10, 20, 40, 50 million solar masses or thereabouts. They don't typically obey the rules. Right? They are not a stellar mass objects of 50 solar masses or 10 solar masses or something thereabouts. They do something drastically different. And there again, the structure of the system around such an object becomes very different. But again, in terms of the theory, we can all summarize this in saying that our subgrid model, what the behavior is on a small scale, really becomes important in a case like that. That concludes my summary of these two or three pages in the book. Right? I've done this deliberately in order to show you what the general steps are and how we can connect this detailed treatment to what we can do in other stellar systems.